The headlines: Russia warns the European Union that any further deterioration in ties between Brussels and Moscow could have unpredictable consequences. Libyan delegates at UN-facilitated talks choose a transitional prime minister and a three-member presidency council to govern the war-torn country until December elections. And also in our headlines, thousands of Indian farmers rally in opposition to the government's new agricultural laws, gathering pace across the country. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half-hour: Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says any further deterioration in ties with the EU could have unpredictable consequences. Lavrov said Russia considers the European Union to be an unreliable partner. He was commenting on possible EU sanctions against Moscow over the detention of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Lavrov said the question of sanctions is an internal EU matter, but he added Russia had noticed how Brussels was increasingly behaving like the United States. Lavrov made the comments at a joint press conference with EU top diplomat Josep Borrell in Moscow. Borrell said ties between the two sides is at a low level. He said he hoped Russia's COVID vaccine could be certified for use in the bloc. Russia has expelled diplomats from Germany, Sweden, and Poland for attending last month's protests in support of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. In a statement, the foreign ministry said Moscow considers the actions of the diplomats unacceptable. Meanwhile, Sweden has reacted to the expulsion of its diplomat, calling it, quote, completely unfounded. The move by the Kremlin comes amid heightened tensions between Russia and Europe over Navalny's alleged poisoning and his recent imprisonment. He was arrested last month after returning from Germany, where he had been receiving treatment. His arrest then triggered unauthorized street protests in a number of cities. Russia has repeatedly said that Navalny's case is an internal affair and that it won't allow any foreign interference in it. A UN-led Libya forum has elected an interim government to run the war-ravaged country until general elections scheduled for December. Libyan delegates at the forum voted for Abdulhamid Dbeiba to become the interim prime minister. They also selected Mohamed Al-Menfi as the head of a three-member presidency council. The UN says the council will be tasked with reuniting state institutions and ensuring security until the presidential and parliamentary elections in Libya. The vote comes as part of a UN peacekeeping process, which hopes to end more than a decade of conflict. Oil-rich North African nation plunged into chaos after a NATO-backed uprising, which led to the ouster of longtime ruler Muammar Gaddafi back in 2011. Since then, the country has been ruled by two seats of power based in the cities of Tripoli and Tobruk. A fragile ceasefire agreed in October has largely held. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. Stay tuned. On this news review, more than 10,000 Indian farmers have held a fresh rally against the government's controversial agricultural reforms as the protest movement gains momentum. The Friday protest was held in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh, with participants coming from across the political and religious spectrum. Hundreds of police forces stood by, but there were no reports of violence. Protest leaders said thousands more would head to the capital, New Delhi, unless the government repeals a set of laws enacted in September. India has been the scene of protests by farmers for months now. The protesters say the new laws benefit large corporations at the expense of smaller producers. The Indian government argues the reforms open up new opportunities for farmers. Nearly a dozen rounds of talks between government and farmer representatives have failed to make a breakthrough. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent, Munawwar Zaman, who's joining us from New Delhi. We also have Mr. Reza Kazem, political commentator, joining us from London. Mr. Kazem is also a member of the Human Rights Commission in London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with our correspondent in New Delhi. Munawwar, tell us more about these demonstrations and how they are spreading right now.
Well, till yesterday, it looked like a different story. It was totally different when there was a lot of tussle on social media, and it looked like that it started gaining more momentum and it came into limelight. But today, there was a huge protest held in BJP-ruled state in Uttar Pradesh in the district of Sirsa, where more than thousands, tens of thousands of people gathered despite prohibitory orders by the government not to converge or not to protest. But it looks like it has started gaining more and more momentum across the country. The farmers' leader, Rakesh Tikait, has today announced that he will ask people to come out for their support in more and more numbers. He has said that we will ask people from every village, one tractor and 15 people, and all of them will start heading towards New Delhi if the demands are not met. Well, at the same time, there was a lot of happenings in the parliament today. In both houses of the parliament, there were a lot of uproar happening about these agricultural reforms. The agricultural minister has said that we don't see anything that what these farmers union call black laws. Can they tell us what is black in it? But these are the laws that we are giving them that will uplift their livelihoods and get their markets right. But here in the capital city, we see a lot of developments going on. The farmers' issue is something which has come into a total limelight because it has started gaining a huge momentum now, with the social media talking about it, with big celebrities talking about it, with even a common man talking about it. At the same time, the police officials, the government ministers have held a meeting this evening and trying to find out ways how to deal with these protests. They have seen all the three sides of Delhi barricaded the capital city using barbed wires and huge barricades, and they have dug up roads, used spikes to stop such incidents that took place on the Republic Day when there was a huge violence near the iconic Red Fort. So they're trying to make sure nothing of that sort happens, but well, looks like it has started gaining more and more momentum, but I see the government is also willing. They're saying we're ready to talk. At the same time, farmers have said, look, you have given us laws, you have passed certain bills in both houses of the parliament without our consultation. You should have referred these laws to the committee to review them. Then if you would have passed laws, that the story was something else. But make a conducive environment for talks. This is the demands of the farm leaders. First, make the conducive atmosphere for the talks. First, remove these barricades. These are people of your own country. Well, some elements are calling them vested interests. Some are calling them terrorists. Well, look, Bardia, honestly speaking, I've been covering this farmers' issue over the last decade. I have seen farmers suicide in an unabated manner across the rural parts of the country. Farmers are killing themselves. You could see there are figures on Google. There are so many reports that these small farmers who have not more than 2 acres of land and their family and livelihood depends on that land. But what they are demanding is the safeguard of their future. Back to you.
All right, let's cross over to Reza Kazem in London. Mr. Kazem, are these reforms not fair, as the protests are arguing so far? The government says that it is going to open up new opportunities, but the protesters say that it will not benefit the agricultural sector in India.
Yeah, I think one of the issues that has very much come to light is the fact that big corporations are going to be able to demand their asking prices and limit at what price the farmers are actually going to be able to sell at. And it is the other thing is to actually drive out the opportunity for the farmers to be in a collectively strong position where the corporations will be able to divide and use the resources for their benefit. And some of these corporations are going to make huge amounts of money while the person who is on the front line doing all the work is not going to be able to benefit from what the farm, you know, what he's going to be producing. And I think that's fundamentally the issue that has, or one of the issues that has come to light with regards to the way these laws, when they start to be implemented, are going to impact on ordinary people. And there's a reason that they've been passed in through the back door. Is without that consultation that was being requested, is because this is something that is going to cause huge problems, and there would be a lot of resistance for that to actually happen. And I think that's what's going on at the moment.
Well, our correspondent, Munawwara in New Delhi, just said that there has to be an environment which makes talks conducive right now. What's the way forward? Is the government in New Delhi going to listen to the protesters as these demonstrations gain steam, or is there another way forward right now?
I think the conduciveness to the talks and so on is that the environment wasn't created before, and now that the government is feeling the brunt of the people's wrath in terms of their demonstrations and their protests and so on, what they're finding is that it's going to be very difficult to continue to have that dialogue until there are going to be serious changes. To build momentum for people on the ground is more challenging than for the government to actually pass laws, because of the majority that they hold, and are in essence not accountable to anyone apart from their pockets and the amount of money that they will have to actually make as a result of these corporations getting the powers that they need through the enactment of these laws. And so I think when they talk about this, we know that the Modi government is also going to try, as it has done in other past issues, to try and see how they can break the protests, how they can divide the protests, and how they can make sure that these protesters are going to be looking like people who are not intrinsic to the fabric of India. And I think that's one of the things that will need to be judged as we go forward, whether the protesters can actually hold out until the government actually reels back on what it has actually passed and sees what can actually be done about it to limit the damage that these corporations are going to do. And, we'll see.
All right, Munawwara, let's get your final thoughts on the issue as well. Is there a light at the end of the tunnel with regards to the standoff between the protesters and the government?
Well, it looks like there is a possibility. Today there was a huge uproar in both houses of the parliament. It looks like both parties are looking way forward to the dialogue. At the same time, there is some sort of momentum. It was a limited, as government maintains that it is limited to one state of Punjab, which they also connected it to one of the movements of Khalistan or whatever they call it. I don't want to go deep into that. That's a totally different topic. But look, yes, I would possibly say that there is a way out. I believe the talks will happen. The government is lending its support, lending its hand, saying, farmers, we want to talk with you. But the farmers are saying, you first make the environment conducive. You first suspend the laws. Then we will speak. But as we start, the BJP rules state in Uttar Pradesh, where prohibitory orders were issued. Despite the fact it's a BJP ruled state, tens of thousands of people gather. Well, it looks like it's gaining momentum day by day. So there is a lot of uncertainty looming at the moment. Let's see what unfolds next.
All right, thanks a lot. Munawwara Zaman joining us from New Delhi, and also thanks to Mr. Reza Kazem, political commentator and member of the Islamic Human Rights Council, joining us from the British capital, London. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here on Dubai for Now. Welcome back. At least 16 Afghan security personnel have been killed in overnight fighting with armed militants in the rest of northern Kunduz province. According to provincial officials, two security personnel were also wounded, while two others were taken hostage during the assault. They said insurgents attacked a checkpoint in Khanabad district of Kunduz. No group has claimed responsibility for the ambush, but Afghan security officials have blamed the raid on the Taliban militant group. The country has seen a spike in bomb and gun attacks in recent months, despite an ongoing peace negotiation between the Taliban and the Afghan government in Doha. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya has slammed Israel for demolishing a Bedouin village in the occupied West Bank.
This settler colonial phenomena, we have seen it, replacing people by people, replacing indigenous people with settlers. The Palestinians have been here for thousands of years. This land is our land. We are here to protect it. We have been cultivating it.
Shetaya said the Israeli demolition is part of ongoing measures in breach of international law and humanitarian treaties. The EU representative to the Palestinian territories also urged Israel to respect international law. The two officials were speaking after they visited the demolished Palestinian village. Israeli forces, accompanied by bulldozers, destroyed homes of some 60 Palestinian Bedouins on Wednesday. Israel claimed the homes were illegal. An Israeli rights group said the demolition left 61 people homeless, over half of them children. The Israeli army says an unarmed Palestinian man has been shot dead in the occupied West Bank. The army said the Palestinian had tried to infiltrate a home after entering a West Bank settlement outpost. The Israeli army said the home belonged to a worker who was attacked by the Palestinian. It said the two struggled and a third person shot and killed the Palestinian. No other injuries have been reported. Palestinian media say the slain man was from a village west of the West Bank city of Ramallah. They reported the head of the village is saying that Israeli forces had seized the body of the man. As the world marks Cancer Day, cancer patients in the Gaza Strip are struggling with grave dangers. Gaza's hospitals can't provide the patients with adequate diagnosis and treatment amid chronic shortages of medicines due to the Israeli blockade. Asher Shannon has more in this report.
February 4th is World Cancer Day, and on this day, thousands of Gazan cancer patients suffer immensely due to the crippling Israeli blockade. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before being able to receive treatment. Gaza hospitals suffer from acute shortage of medicines, especially for cancer patients. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished enclave can be a stressful and unpredictable process, and many apply multiple times before being able to exit.
Israel usually doesn't allow Palestinian patients to travel through the Erez crossing despite having an exit permit. They only need to leave the Gaza Strip to receive required treatments.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment with a 50% deficit rate. Despite the high number of cancer cases in Gaza, the Israeli regime also refuses to allow spare parts for radiation therapy machines to enter Gaza.
Radiation therapy, especially for breast cancer patients, is not available in the Gaza Strip, and patients must go to hospitals in Israel or the occupied West Bank for treatment. Radiation therapy is a hard process and takes a very long time to get an Israeli permit for such procedures. Oftentimes, cancer patients miss their hospital appointments due to delayed exit permits.
There are around 14,000 cancer patients in the Gaza Strip, 47% male and 53% female. Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among females. Cancer patients have also complained of humiliating treatment at the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing.
The process in the Israeli crossing is extremely humiliating because they insist on strip searching you. I was very sick and they kept interrogating me for 3 hours and then they began to strip search me. I told them that I had a mastectomy, but the Israelis did not let me go through until they did a full body search.
Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to further deteriorate.
Human rights organizations in the Gaza Strip have repeatedly urged the international community to help bring an end to the Israeli blockade and save the lives of cancer patients. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bahizi, 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 Ey shahidon rahe khuda, Ey karde, Bahre ehyay haq jan fada, Kas patre, خون پاک شما می روید.
the limelight.
By now, the world that does not watch Fox News knows that very early on, Donald Trump was aware of the dangers of this pandemic, but refused to act because it might make him look weak, says William Riverspitch, senior editor and lead columnist, in an article titled, Americans did not lose loved ones and normal life to COVID. They were stolen. Stay tuned for the details, please. There is a great deal of talk about loss as Americans slug into the newest month of this long COVID winter. The lost lives, more than 441,000 people in the U.S. alone, are top of mind. The loss of livelihoods as businesses crumble under the weight of the pandemic. The loss of food and home security, a new truth for so many as hunger and eviction talk, millions of people everywhere. Yet, loss itself is a passive word. It's what happens to your lap when you stand up. Proof is gone. The fact of the matter is, those lives, livelihoods, and bare sense of security at the table and in the home were not lost. They were stolen from Americans over a deliberate run of months that saw the previous administration ignore, obfuscate, and outright lie about the quiet massacre that continues to devour the U.S. By now, the world that does not watch Fox News knows that very early on, Donald Trump was aware of the dangers of this pandemic, but refused to act because it might make him look weak. Moves to curb the spread of the virus, such as invoking the Defense Production Act, were not deployed because they were deemed ideologically unsound. How can government be an agent of positive good if government is the problem? According to Ronald Reagan, there is no squaring this circle. They allowed base capitalist motives to drive the bus, for no other reason than to avoid making capitalism look bad. But the vaccines, Trump's defenders will bray. We got them done so fast. We did that happened. The push to see these vaccines into existence is commendable. And the fact that the science and medical communities actually pulled it off is nothing short of astonishing. This is not to be denied. Yet, that's the one thing Trump and his people actively did to curtail this thing. Everything else, all the other necessities like testing, contact tracing, masks, and fundamentally responsible leadership by example, all were left to rot by the roadside for purely personal and political reasons. When the Biden administration came into the White House, they discovered that Operation Warp Speed, the plan to get vaccines massively distributed, was little more than a few wisps of smoke. Shipments of vaccine are spoiling because there was no network to distribute them. The elderly are made to wait in day-long lines to receive the shots. Communities of color are finding themselves far at the back of the line. Across the U.S., the Trump-fed hope that the vaccine would save Americans and his re-election hopes crashed headlong into the reality that we can't get the vaccine because Trump's people failed to organize the process. That, amazingly enough, is not even the worst part. Top Trump officials actively lobbied Congress to deny state governments any extra funding for the COVID-19 vaccine rollout last fall. Reports the scientific news journal Stat, despite frantic warnings from state officials that they didn't have the money they needed
to ramp up a massive vaccination operation. Without the extra money, states spent last October and November rationing the small pot of federal dollars they had been given. And when vaccines began shipping in December, states seemed woefully underprepared. Reaction from those affected by this wrecking nonsense was swift. On December 4th, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials and the Association of Immunization Managers sent a harsh letter to Surgeon General Jerome Adams. Recent communications by senior administration officials to Congress indicate that this administration and some members of Congress do not support our request for substantial additional resources for vaccine administration and infrastructure. We believe that it is neither a partisan nor political statement to share the very obvious fact that the vaccination of 33 million Americans safely and effectively will take far more than $340 million currently allocated to local, state, and territorial governmental public health agencies. Not only did they ignore and disdain the threat of COVID-19, not only did they comprehensively fail to prepare for the necessities of vaccination distribution, they actively lobbied to strip funding from states that were trying to get things organized. We need to stop talking about loss when it comes to the Trump administration's handling of COVID-19. Dining at a restaurant, going to a concert, taking kids to the park, crowding around the family table for a holiday meal, all the mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, wives, husbands, and friends who are gone forever. These were not lost. They were stolen. Never forget that and never forgive it.
Iran Today.
It survived its 40th to celebrate a 42nd anniversary. That's Iran's Islamic Revolution of 1979, commemorating its 10-day dawn beginning 31st January in 2021. It begins with the return date of the first leader of the revolution, the late Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, all those decades ago. And it ends with the revolution. The day called Islamic Revolution's Victory Day, or 22nd of Bahman. That traditionally falls to the 11th of February. It's not the first time we cover the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, but this year our angle is how the revolution has survived over four decades riddled with hostility. Is the secret in some sort of natural resistance it has, or survival skills? Perhaps a little of both. For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Resilience is almost an undeniable attribute of the revolution, looking at its 40th. That was in 2019, when the country faced renewed hostility by America's Trump administration and their attempt at regime change in Iran, to put it in American terms. Our guest tells us what he sees as the key to the revolution's resilience or endurance. Mr. Kanani Moghaddam is himself a veteran of the revolution, with an honest look to the pros and cons of all ups and downs that have ensued since 1979.
اولا انقلاب اسلامی ایران یکی از First, one of the principles of Iran's Islamic revolution, which has allowed it to remain a dynamic and developmental movement, is the fact that it's based on people's votes. Our revolution has been a people's revolution, and it's this support that has sustained it and made it resistant to threats and sanctions. The next point was the leadership of the revolution itself. People looked at Imam Khomeini and saw in him all the qualities of a charismatic, popular leader and a religious man. They saw a politician and trusted him. This is people's trust in the leadership. This made the people willing to send their youth to the battlefields when the revolution was in danger, such as during the Iraq-Iran war.
You say Iran's ruling system hasn't yet fully evolved. That could be good. In what direction should it evolve in order to continue its survival with the satisfaction of the people?
Over the past 42 years, we have had costly experiences, victories, defeats, ups and downs. All these experiences must be gathered to be used for reforming the structures and laws in the system and even the constitution. That is, where we see a legal vacuum, we must correct it and move forward. If we make a problematic law, we should set it aside and make more progressive laws. If we have made mistakes that have caused us to deviate from the main path, God forbid, or there have been weaknesses there, we must make up for it. By preserving the principles and ideals of the revolution and its main slogans, we must improve and address the situations day by day.
This nation has managed to establish a system of Islamic Republic and an independent system of government. That is, a government not beholden to America, but dependent on national support. You may wonder about that looking at Iran's anti-government riots bubbling and subsiding since 2017. But over 40 years ago, Ruhollah Khomeini's slogans appealed to the people's sense of pride and independence in the face of Western imperialism and socialist revolutions. Actually, this appeal has been a lasting one and a cause of the revolution enduring all ups and downs, according to Mr. Taraki.
One important factor that has been able to increase this resilience is looking at one's own internal capacities and capabilities and not relying on the outside and not being dependent on the external powers. Other factor is the young human capital and Muslims and believers who have been supporting the revolution, protecting it against the enemies during crises, wars, and other challenges by showing stability and resistance.
Imam Khomeini's slogans of liberation from Western imperialism and socialist revolutions shored up Iranian resistance to America. And it didn't stop there, but went on to inspire anti-Western movements across oppressed developing countries. There have been protests in Iran from time to time over economic woes created by different administrations' shortcomings and mismanagement. But Iranians are aware of the role U.S. sanctions have played in diminishing their food and medical baskets. Also, the people are aware that if there's room for criticism at home, a foreign power certainly can't be trusted with their best interests. In other words, in the face of a foreign adversary, Iranians tend to stick together.
More than that, Iran is a survivor, not of 40 years of adversity, but of thousands of years of foreign tribes breaching its borders or trying to. So even the unpolitical, if there are such Iranians, do tend to join forces to pull away from foreign dependency in another way. In the face of sanctions and power threats, the Iranian nation and government alike tend to strive for industrial, technological, and military know-how to get their independence. They aspired to it before the revolution, and with 40 years gained, they have come a long way in achieving those aspirations. Today, it's dubbed resistance economy, which is to promote domestic production when sanctions block imports of goods and raw materials to the country. I asked why Iran had focused so closely on its missile industry for military independence at a time of sanctions and no imports of advanced weapons systems. Mr. Taraki is a former MP now entrusted with sensitive administrative positions. He explains.
One of the factors that can ground the enemy in the distance and prevents the invasion of our country is missiles. We have reached a level of technical capability that we can produce precision-guided missiles. This means we can target only the enemy's military forces where they are operating from and won't result in collateral damage to civilians. This military doctrine is the best and most humane. This prevents incidents like those in the Yemen war, where instead of targeting the Yemeni military, Saudi Arabia bombs schools and hospitals. This is a sign of weakness and lack of humane military doctrine.
As for Iran finding its means of survival in its own domestic economy, the country's non-oil trade's gross revenues have grown 83% in the previous couple of years. And in December, the central bank governor said the nation's financial system had grown by 1.3% from March to mid-September. It is small and medium-sized corporations that are driving the expansion of Iranian manufacturing. About 1,000 of them have created or reinstated 17,000 jobs. These businesses account for 92% of Iran's manufacturing enterprises and 45% of its industrial jobs. Iran's unemployment over the previous decade has increased to 9.5% from 12.3%. Many have lost their jobs due to COVID-19, at least temporarily, say domestics, barred from entering others' homes. But the above-said industrial corporations have apparently helped overall national employment figures. Mr. Mansouri narrates the revolutionary line of events since 1979. Let's hear him out.
Our national production increased last year. This shows that the country's labor force has understood the situation and is working. Most foreign goods are produced domestically. Iranians are making products including automobile parts, home appliances, and meeting the needs that were previously had to be fulfilled through imports. Now, we're entering an era when we say we can be the manufacturers of those products.
How long that may last if foreign investors continue to keep away due to U.S. secondary sanctions for dealing with Iran, it's not easy to tell. But then, Iran has its Eastern and Latin American partners. We've come to that moment when it's time to take a look at what other media outlets have to say. So let's return indoors from the Revolution Documents Center here. Finally, a close-up of other media outlets, beginning with Ahlul Bayt. The Islamic Revolution's astounding endurance for 42 years. Why is it? The president says Islamic Revolution is a purely cultural revolution, and that's where he sees the secret, apparently. Congratulating the arrival of the 10-day Fajr celebration and the anniversary of the glorious victory of the Islamic Revolution, President Rouhani said the Islamic Revolution of Iran has been a movement based on culture, religion, ethics, and to perform religious and Islamic duties from the very beginning. Speaking on Tuesday, January the 26th, in the meeting of the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution, Dr. Rouhani referred to the process of the victory of the Islamic Revolution from 16 years before the revolution and the beginning of the movement until 42 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and said, "It is a cultural and religious movement that has distinguished the Islamic Revolution of Iran from other revolutions in the world." Dr. Rouhani stated that in all stages of the beginning of the Islamic movement and the path taken until the victory of the revolution, the leadership of the movement was the responsibility of the late Imam Khomeini and the grand clerics and religious people who were at the forefront of the fight for the victory of the revolution. Mehr News has a question. Why is the West not after constructive ties with the Iranian revolution? For almost 42 years, Westerners have been claiming that the Iranian revolution is coming to its end every year. However, it is the liberal democracy that reached its end, especially after the U.S. post-election events. Today, the Islamic Revolution of Iran marks the 42nd anniversary of its victory, while a few years ago, John Bolton, Trump's national security advisor, had claimed that the Iranian Revolution would not see its 40th anniversary. Like many Western politicians, John Bolton's words could have been used as propaganda at the time, but the point is why the West speaks so angrily about the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Basically, what is the secret of the Iranian Revolution that the Westerners keep imposing economic sanctions and cultural aggression and organizing plots, conspiracies, and disintegration scenarios against the Islamic Revolution? Have other revolutions been like this? The answer is no. The reason is clear. The Iranian Revolution was not supposed to stay within the borders due to its characteristics. Moving on to the national interest, which does point out where interest really lies, Biden team must understand Iran to build a nuclear deal. As the Biden administration pursues new negotiations with Iran, it should do so with a keen understanding of Iranian strategic decision-making and what spurs Iranian flexibility and obduracy. The key to any broader deal will be to find areas that address U.S. national security concerns that do not infringe on what Iranian officials regard as vital to their country's survival. Today, no one in the Iranian political spectrum entertains the idea of giving concessions on Iran's missile capabilities. Hossein Salami, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, summarized the consensus position in Iran on the missiles issue, stating, "Missiles are defensive assets and a key element of our deterrence power, and we can never accept to disarm ourselves of deterrence capabilities." That's it for the news segment, but please stay on for our own narrative. We've said quite a bit on the fight for independence and independence to win the fight. So let's dissect the concept of independence. To the revolution, it consists of two things. The first is rejection of the ideological supremacy of Western liberalism with its exploitative capitalism and Eastern socialism. Second is elimination of Western imperialistic influence within Iran and the Muslim world. To achieve the latter, Islamic ideological precepts were prioritized to redesign domestic governance and foreign relations.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution has advised us to become stronger. We cannot talk of independence without becoming strong. If we depend on the military powers of the world to protect ourselves, or on the economies of the countries that are our enemies, this no longer means independence.
In confronting domineering powers, the revolution's four decades have seen four periods of hostility, pragmatism, confrontation, and diplomacy. The first period, that's early hostility and confrontation, was from 1979 for a decade, when Iran managed to thwart existential threats posed by the Western and Arab-backed Iraqi attack on this country. General Qurbani of the Iranian Army's Aerospace Division shared with us real experiences related. We visited him at his shipshape organized headquarters, where manners followed a standard even with foot soldiers. You don't see that everywhere just because it's military.
We had the issue of the armed movements in the west of the country. They staged an armed uprising. Pave was being besieged. Shahid Kishvari, along with Shahid Shiridi and other pilots, made the first night flight and liberated Pave. We had some 30 martyrs while liberating and dealing with armed conflicts of Kurdistan. At the beginning of the Iraq war on Iran, pilots like Shahid Kishvari and Shirudi carried out search and kill operations. That is, they did it by themselves and did not take orders. They targeted an Iraqi tank they spotted by Cobra helicopters.
The period of pragmatism and flexibility was of the 1990s and early 2000s, when Iran attempted to court European powers and the US, but with little success. Let's not forget that even the pro-Western pre-revolution monarchy fell out of favor with the US and Britain when Iran nationalized its oil and subsequently tried to further raise its price.
Every new president who came to power in Iran thought his predecessor's policies couldn't solve the problems, so he chose another policy. But the truth of the matter is something else. As we speak, the chairman of the U.S. Foreign Affairs Committee says if Iran recognizes Israel, it wouldn't be a problem even if it wants to have a nuclear weapon. He said it plainly and explicitly.
The third period en route to independence was open confrontation against the West from 2006 to 2013. And the fourth period, that's a return to diplomacy, came in 2013. It was the Rouhani administration's policy of flexibility that gave way to the 2015 nuclear deal. But Donald Trump ditched the deal in May 2018, and economic nuclear-related UN sanctions relieved by the nuclear deal or JCPOA rushed back at Iran as US sanctions. We've established the revolution has a natural resistance or resilience due to its spiritual concept, but it owes its endurance to other factors too, namely Iranian survival skills and determination for survival. This determination is intensified every time the country is denied something. For some years now, Iran has been pursuing a look-to-east policy. For the first three decades after the revolution of 1979, it imported weapons systems, mostly from Russia, China, and North Korea. But now, it is producing most all the means it needs to independently secure its own and regional state safety and export to major countries. The Iraq-Iran War of the 1980s was inspiration enough, inspiration that led to aspiration that never stopped. And now Iran is making from battle tanks and submarines to sophisticated unmanned aerial vehicles and long-range ballistic missiles. Not to forget, for some 20 years or so, Iran has been making several planes and helicopters, such as Azarakhsh, Sayegh, and Sabah. Iran also possesses varied range national radar systems such as Bavar 373. The country realizes, however, the importance of maintenance, so Iran procures and produces the spare parts needed to maintain its legacy systems, including its fleet of U.S. manufactured fighter jets purchased before 1979.
We have the fifth biggest helicopter fleet in the world. The maintenance and overhauling of our helicopters were one day done by the Americans. But all these years, our flight engineers, tech guys, and pilots carried out the maintenance. Only two or three countries have the technology to build night vision systems. But thanks to knowledge-based companies, the youth at the universities, flight engineers, and our brave pilots, night vision systems are being built domestically.
The country's military produce is just meant as a deterring force against America and allies. But the longer U.S. influence in the region continues, the more Iran asserts its involvement in regional matters. Iran propped up the axis of resistance comprising Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah. And it was instrumental in defeating sporadically U.S.-backed terror groups such as Daesh. 2014 was a particularly noteworthy achievement.
The military doctrine of the Islamic Republic, of course, is to first increase the defense capabilities in such a way that no power can invade it. Second, to increase deterrence to such an extent that the enemy doesn't dare to threaten the Iranian nation. Third, to move its defense borders beyond its usual geographical borders and to fight the enemy in the distance so that the enemy cannot even get close to the borders of Iran.
Between 2015 and 2019, Iran annually spent 4 to 5% of its gross domestic product, GDP, on defense. That's $18 to $22 billion. Although Iran's defense figures tend to dwindle with every round of sanctions diminishing its budget, the country's defense spending in the 2020 budget is estimated to be $20.5 billion, even with the U.S.'s harshest ever sanctions weighing it down. Now, it's all very well talking of how many weapons and fleets one might have, but when and how they are used makes it all matter. Intelligence in discovering the weaknesses of the enemy decides the target to aim for. But not every war is a hardware war, a battle of swords.
One of the most important factors that can maintain and sustain any revolution is to know the enemy's plots, the methods that the enemy uses and how to neutralize those. Both the leader of the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini during their leadership continuously informed the people of who the enemies were. They have identified the US and Israel and their allies as the enemies. They comprise the system of domination that's working against the Islamic Revolution.
IRGC intelligence operations cover not only the Islamic Revolution and establishment, but also the geography within which can exist the possible threat for Iran. And it was as early as 2019 that they felt a serious intelligence threat looming. IRGC Chief General Salami said, "We are in an intelligence war with the US and the enemies of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic establishment, and this means a combination of psychological and cyber operations, military movements, public diplomacy, and intimidation." What are the main objectives of Iran's foreign policy? The Iranian Revolution intended itself as a revolt against domestic dictatorship as well as the international world system, which the revolutionaries found unjust. Iran became an active member of the non-aligned movement under the Cold War, chanting "Neither East nor West," a slogan which, in promoting independence from both Eastern and Western blocs, prioritized unity among the Muslim nations, and eventually among all the oppressed people of the world. With the collapse of the Soviet Union and end of the Cold War, Iran's foreign policy became focused on resisting the US's unilateralism in world politics by making an unannounced alliance between developing countries.
The foreign policy of the Islamic Republic is based on religious and Islamic principles in the Constitution. In this foreign policy, defending the dignity of Islam is paramount. After that, there is the protection of national interests. Next is the defense of world's oppressed that's emphasized in foreign policy. The fourth point is opposition to arrogant and hegemonic policies in the world. This again lies in the same anti-arrogance principles of the Islamic Republic. In addition to all this is friendship with all countries, exchange and interaction with all countries of the world, except illegitimate and domineering countries such as Israel and the United States.
There goes another anniversary and another episode of our show. But we will be back next week and each week after, so do return to the box at the same times and don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.